For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, which was the last newsletter before Christmas 2025. And hence, in addition to thanking all the Cratchits and others who've supported our work, we send a Feliz Navidad to viewers in Spain, who've made it number 13 on our all-time list of views by jurisdiction. And then, in the spirit of Nephew Fred, and a Happy New Year, because our first item in the newsletter, a climate carol, took readers to the abode of climate activist Professor Ebenezer Kluge, sitting comfortably in his well-heated and brightly lit home, contemplating how much happier the poor must be without all those nasty fossil fuels, home appliances, and other burdens of modern life. But suddenly, an ominous clanking was heard, and a specter burst into his living room, the ghost of his recently deceased colleague Jacob Modeler, shaking a massive spectral chain of fudged datasets, retracted papers, and angry hyperbole, and beseeching Kluge to change his ways while there was still time. Kluge protested that his old colleague was always a reliable man for the cause, only to elicit an agonized cry that, "Research was my cause! Its integrity was my cause!" followed by a disquieting declaration that three spirits would visit Kluge before morning, those of climate past, climate present, and climate yet to come, and he'd better listen up. Then the ghost vanished out the window, showing Kluge the forlorn specters of deceased scientists who were trying to look up actual facts and contest absurd rhetoric, but had lost the power to do so. And there's more where that came from, along with the figgy pudding. The spirit of climate past showed him Earth's past, the extraordinary fluctuations in climate not due to greenhouse gases, the flourishing of life under warm conditions, the bleakness of glaciations, and the glories of the Holocene climatic optimum, as well as the bitterness of the Little Ice Age. Then the spirit of climate present showed him country after country that wasn't warming faster than the average, also presented him with detailed records of cyclones, wildfires, and so on, and then, rather more distressingly, presented him with a scholar named Ignorance, who had no idea how the supposedly reliable datasets were cobbled together, and then took him to an IPCC gathering where politicians were writing their own summaries for policymakers that were fit to drive the authors of the supposedly underlying science to bedlam. But also, encouragingly, it took him to the offices of brave and happy researchers who were welcoming rather than suppressing unexpected findings. Then, suddenly, Kluge found himself instead outside a ruined university on a bleak December night, where an ominous shadow in black crepe showed him a world where net zero, sequestration, and geoengineering had brought back the ice and killed millions. Clutching its chilly robe, a repentant Kluge cried, "Oh, spirit, tell me the planet's not already dead." And it wasn't. So from that day forward, he debated respectfully with colleagues, included error bars in all his charts, and wrote indignant letters to newspapers when idiotic climate hyperbole got printed as sober fact. In the process, he lost a few friends that he realized he'd never much liked anyway, but he got back his self-respect and never regretted the bargain. And he wasn't alone. As the late Andrew Breitbart often and wisely said, politics is downstream of culture. So those who've tried to change climate policy while ducking scientific debate have found their efforts remarkably frustrating. But once public thinking about the alleged crisis changes, it's a whole different story. As, for instance, with Politico noting that, quote, "climate backsliding comes for blue state governors," end quote. Once proudly green against the dreaded orange, they've suddenly realized that their constituents have other concerns, and guess what happens? Likewise, Climate Depot cites a couple of posts from Bjorn Lomborg about how, quote, "for a decade, climate change has been one of the most important issues in the EU, not any longer," end quote. And, quote, "young Swedes, climate no longer engaging. New Swedish study finds the social issue that has lost the most engagement since 2019 is climate," end quote. Also, it being the season of goodwill and all that there, at time of writing, and indeed at time of filming, we congratulate Inside Climate News, again, for a headline, quote, "a massive Chinese-backed port in Peru could push the Amazon rainforest over the edge," end quote. And then, it being the season of ill will and all that there, the Associated Press sits there hating the Whos, including Americans evidently poised to spend over $1 trillion on Christmas gifts for the first time ever, boo this, quote, "all of those processes release planet-warming gases into the atmosphere," end quote. But they have plenty of festive suggestions, from organizing someone's passwords as a gift to a mason jar full of beans to buy less stuff to one the Grinch's dentist would love, which is putting a toothbrush in their stockings this year. The look on their faces will be priceless, no doubt. And now, a word from our sponsor, which, as always, is you. And I've mentioned before, I feel a bit awkward asking for money. I figure people don't like being asked. We understand that many of you are giving what you can, and we get letters from people saying, gee, I wish I could do more, but I'm on a fixed income, I've got a family to feed. So again, we're so grateful to everybody who gives, whether it's $2 a month or one time $50, one time £75. But we are up against very well-funded, government-funded climate alarmists. So if you value our work and you haven't already made a contribution, please do become a sponsor. $2 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month, whatever you can afford, so that we can get back to doing what we love best, which is this. We also note that on climate, many taboos seem to be shattering, including that someone just gave us a bottle of sparkling English wine, and I want to insist, it's not someone who hates us. Also, the University of Cambridge warns of crop failure due to climate change, and no, they don't mean warmth. Instead, it was about how a series of volcanic eruptions around 1345 AD caused temperatures to drop and crops to fail. And then, when ingenious Italian merchants expanded trade into the Black Sea in quest of food, alas, they brought back the plague as well as the bacon. What's next? A medieval warm period and a little ice age? Warmth favors crops and cold kills them? Egad. In the newsletter, we then return to a recurring topic: whether it matters to alarmists and their audience when they're wrong. Because in exiting Mark Carney's Canadian federal cabinet in a huff over this memorandum of misunderstanding, former scofflaw environment and climate change minister, who'd already been reduced to Minister of Canadian Identity and Culture and Minister Responsible for Official Languages, Minister of Nature and Parks Canada, and Carney's lieutenant in Quebec, Stephen Guilbeault wrote, quote, "Over the past 10 years, our country has made historic progress in reducing climate pollution," end quote. But it hasn't. And what's more, a big problem in government, not only in Canada, is that politicians are so isolated from bad news by this elaborate PR system that portrays every trifling step or major misstep as a historic achievement, that they really have very little idea when they've lapsed into obvious absurdity, claiming credit for stuff that just didn't happen. And look, at CDN, we are not naives, okay? We expect politicians to be blatherskites, but we think there ought to be some limits. Instead, Guilbeault's colleague, Finance Minister François-Philippe Champagne, who apparently earned promotion to that post due to his facility as Minister of Industry in handing huge no-strings-attached subsidies to EV battery makers who promptly went bust or invested the money in the United States, he prated that Guilbeault was a great friend who, quote, has contributed in many ways to our country and will continue to do so, end quote, but, quote, I think Canadians understand the world has changed, end quote. Yeah. Changed how? Surely, in the views of such persons as F.P. Champagne and S. Guilbeault, what has changed is that the weather has become spectacularly worse due to evil human carbon pollution. And indeed, in Canada's National Post, veteran pundit Kelly McParland quotes former Canadian Environment Minister and veteran alarmist Catherine McKenna in the run-up to COP30 and as her third and final report as chair of the grandly named United Nations High-Level Expert Group on the Net Zero Emissions Commitments of Non-State Entities, end quote, that, quote, climate isn't going away. It's getting worse all the time, end quote. No, indeed. Climate isn't going away. It's all around us. It's what's all around us. Where would it go? But also, how's it getting worse? Do neither politicians nor journalists care what the alleged factual basis is, and whether it's sound? Speaking of which, a report from a guy who's been claiming that climate change was pushing up insurance costs for years, so the government should give insurance companies free money, who's at an institute named for and funded by, say it ain't so, an insurance company, just called basement flooding, quote, the number one cost of climate change in Canada, end quote. No. Basement flooding is the number one cost of people building houses in places that have been flooding since the end of the last glaciation. But as Roger Pilkey Jr. just wrote in The Climate Risk Industrial Complex and the Manufactured Insurance Crisis, which is part one of a series, quote, a climate risk industrial complex has emerged in this space, and a lot of money is being made by a lot of people. The virtuous veneer of climate advocacy serves to discourage scrutiny and accountability, end quote. But not from him, we can assure you. Or from us. The New York Times, as we've noted, has been walloping on this climate change ate my insurance policy drum for ages. And indeed, RPJ counts more than 1,250 Times articles on climate change and insurance just since 2019. Unfortunately, and despite the fabled skepticism of journalists, it turns out that the insurance industry is raking in the bucks, partly because it's raising premiums on the basis of an alleged increase in risk that hasn't been accompanied by an increase in payouts. And the Times missed it. Oh dear. And another thing. As 2025 wraps up, we take a big picture view, also known as trying to sort out and archive a ton of material that we didn't get to during the year, including on the vexed question of whether the green energy transition is a massive success in the making or a costly bust. We all know what it was meant to be and what we kept being told it was or was about to become. But before breaking out the eggnog or avoiding same, it's worth asking a question not always popular among global warmists. What does the evidence say? And in case you care, is that the more a place bet on alternative energy, the higher prices for power have gotten, the less reliable the power supply has become, and the more the politicians are now panicking. And while you can make excuses or stammer rationalizations on a small scale, when it becomes citywide, statewide, or national, the truth will out. Speaking of which, the latest installment of our deep dive on this summer's U.S. Department of Energy Red Team Climate Report looked at Chapter 3.3, which is urbanization influences on temperatures. And this section started with one of those points that should be obvious, but again, is too often swept under the rug by alarmists. Our record of temperatures over land has been collected by and large where people live. And where people live, people have been changing their surroundings over time, especially by building large cities whose man-made structures and materials, such as asphalt, trap heat, driving up thermometer readings for reasons unrelated to climate change. Which means that the fact that we have records in some places going back to the 1800s doesn't mean that we have good records when it comes to measuring climate change or removing urban heat island distortions. As the Department of Energy team states, rather more diplomatically than we might have, quote, the IPCC acknowledges that raw temperature data are contaminated with UHI effects, but claims to have data cleaning procedures that remove them. It is an open question whether those procedures are sufficient, end quote. But they then proceed to unravel the IPCC claim, and in doing so, they close the question, because it turns out that the IPCC's methodology demonstrably does not find such contamination even in data series independently known to suffer from it. Almost as if they weren't really looking. And a related issue is Canadian summertime warming trends, or lack of them. Dr. Roy Spencer, of the Christie Spencer Satellite Dataset fame, has posted an analysis on his weblog of Canadian June, July, and August daytime highs and nighttime lows from southern locations across six provinces from 1900 to 2023, and it finds this telltale footprint of an urban heat island effect, which is rising nighttime lows without rising daytime highs. And also, weirdly, he found a sharp drop in the number of data monitoring stations, just when politicians claimed that they were devoted to following the science and evidence-based decision-making. Almost as if... but we repeat ourselves. Finally, from the co2science.org archive, whether John Lennon had heard of sphagnum phallax when he wrote Come Together, old flat-top bog moss does have juju eyeballs during part of its growth phase. It seems to be native all over the world, it likes marshy areas, and it likes CO2. In 2018, an experiment with an extra 300 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere found it 98% bigger after 13 weeks. Grooving up quickly, one might say. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, saying bah humbug to unrepentant alarmists. That's right.